20-year-old Kelly Berg Dove switched shifts with her sister at the Imperial Gas Station in Harrisonburg, Virginia. It was supposed to be just another night shift, but this time, something would go terribly wrong. Between midnight and 2:30 a.m., Kelly placed 3 phone calls to 911 about a man harassing her, making obscene phone calls, and even exposing himself. With each of the calls, the fear in her voice grew, and just 2 minutes after her final call, police arrived to find the gas station empty. For 38 years, police and Kelly's family have searched for the truth and been left with only questions. No suspects have ever been named, though a convicted murderer has surely been considered. Now, authorities may be on the precipice of answering some of those haunting questions. This is Trace Evidence, Episode 113, The Abduction of Kelly Berg Dove. Welcome to Trace Evidence. I'm your host, Stephen Pacheco. Today we examine an extremely disturbing case. Before getting into the details, just a few notes about the show. Trace Evidence is a weekly true crime podcast focused on unsolved murders and disappearances. You can follow Trace Evidence on Twitter at TraceEvPod, Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, or by searching Facebook for Trace Evidence. The show is also on MeWe and Minds. If you're interested in supporting the show and getting some Trace Evidence merchandise, there's a Patreon at patreon.com/traceevidence, or you can donate via PayPal. Visit trace-evidence.com for all social media links, donating options, and contact information to submit case suggestions, or you can email me directly at traceevidencepod@gmail.com. Kelly Berg Dove went to work one night, found herself on the receiving end of harassment from a threatening man, made 3 phone calls to police, and by the time they arrived, she was gone without a trace. This is episode 113, The Abduction of Kelly Berg Dove. Kelly Dove turned and walked out from behind the counter. Several hours earlier, she'd come to work at the Imperial Gas Station in Harrisonburg, Virginia, after trading shifts with her sister. In fact, 2 of Kelly's sisters worked at the same gas station, and it wasn't out of the ordinary for them to switch off here and there. The 20-year-old made the short walk from the counter to the wall-mounted payphone, picked up the receiver, and quickly punched in 911. It was early on the morning of Friday, June 18th, 1982, when the 911 operator answered. This was hardly Kelly's first overnight shift, and according to her mother, Rachel, Kelly was a smart young woman who wasn't afraid to be the lone employee working at night. Just 3 hours earlier, Rachel had called her daughter to check on her, but Kelly had been too busy to talk. Around midnight, Kelly called back, and according to Rachel, everything seemed fine. There was no indication of any problems, and it was just another routine night. However, by 2:27 a.m., something had occurred which made Kelly, who wasn't easily frightened, find it necessary to call the police. According to official statements and articles written about this case, Kelly reported to the Harrisonburg police that she'd been on the receiving end of multiple anonymous harassing phone calls, and there was a suspicious male hanging around the outside of the building. It's been suggested in several articles that the harassing phone calls may have been coming from the man outside using a payphone attached to the exterior of the building. The gas station was located at 2141 South Main Street in Harrisonburg, approximately a mile south of James Madison University. Multiple accounts described the location as being isolated along a vacant stretch of road. The gas station itself has since been torn down. An overgrowth of trees consumes much of the former property, with only a paved black tar square and gravel remaining beyond the slope entryways. The Harrisonburg Police Department was located just 3 miles away on North Main Street. Reportedly, Kelly told authorities that she was working alone and requested that they send someone by. According to an article in the Daily Press, transcripts have Kelly saying, quote, "This guy came in earlier and he was kind of dressed improperly, but I kind of ignored him. I think it was that guy because he drove through the parking lot a few seconds before I got the call. Could you, you know, have somebody kind of keep an eye out on me? End quote. This would be the first in a trio of phone calls Kelly made that night, the night she disappeared. All three calls would be made within minutes of each other, depending which report you rely on, as there are several time discrepancies reported over the years. However, while the first call was made with concern, the next two would increase in intensity. While the harassing calls may seem like a cause for concern, Kelly's sister Debbie, a manager at the gas station, later told the News Leader paper that they were almost part of the job, saying, quote, "We get those all the time," end quote. However, in the call, Kelly mentioned that the man had been improperly dressed, and while there's been some debate about what that meant, both investigators and the family have concluded that the man may have exposed himself to Kelly. Kelly Berg was born on August 30th, 1961, to parents Fred and Rachel. The Berg home was a busy one, Kelly being one of four daughters, her sisters, Debbie, Rose, and Elaine, along with a brother and a foster child who was also being raised in the home. Kelly herself was, according to family, a sweet young woman with a sharp mind who had a sense of adventure about her. Elaine, Kelly's younger sister, shared a bedroom with her growing up and learned a lot from her big sister. She later told NBC News, quote, "She never backed down from a challenge and would try things out, such as roller coasters. She made me ride my first one. I was scared, but she gave me the confidence I needed to take on the ride," end quote. Elaine remained close with Kelly until the night she vanished and, to this day, fights to find her sister. In 1977, when Kelly was 15 years old, she was dating a boy named Dale Dove and eventually became pregnant. Kelly and Dale's daughter, Tammy, was born in December of that year. Kelly and Dale later married and moved into a new home together, approximately a 20-minute drive from the Berg home. While she no longer lived with her family, the bond remained tight, especially with Elaine, who has said on multiple occasions that she spent almost every weekend at her sister's house. A few years after the birth of her daughter, Kelly began making plans for the future. She would graduate high school early, registering to attend classes at Blue Ridge Community College, a 20-minute drive down Interstate 81. While Rachel loaned Kelly some money to pay for tuition, Kelly was saving money working at the gas station to cover the rest. She wanted to make her own way, and while the gas station didn't pay a great deal, it gave her the ability to put cash away and ensure she could continue her education. Unfortunately, her job would be the same location she would disappear from, leaving behind an absence in her family and a mystery which continues to haunt them to this day. At approximately 2:29 a.m. on Friday, the 18th, the Harrisonburg Police Department received a second call from Kelly just 2 minutes after her first call. This time, Kelly spoke with more urgency, explaining to the 911 operator that the strange man from the previous call had returned to the gas station, driving a gray or silver vehicle, possibly a Ford. In this call, Kelly explained that the man was speaking obscenities to her. I should note here that there are discrepancies with these two calls. In some accounts, the man exposed himself prior to the first call. In others, Kelly doesn't ask for someone to keep an eye on her until the second call. While the timeline is so sketchy, I can't begin to explain why, but we do know the details are correct, even if they may be somewhat out of order. There are also some issues with the times of the calls, but I'll get more into that later. Twice now, Kelly had to leave her position at the counter of the convenience area to call the police, notifying them about strange calls and a strange man's behavior. Interestingly, on a Facebook post from WHSV ABC 3 News about Kelly's case, there's a comment from Martha Yankee, both the 911 operator answering Kelly's calls, as well as the wife of the first officer to arrive on the scene. According to Miss Yankee, her husband was relayed the information about Kelly's calls after she called the first time. Miss Yankee went on to say, quote, "There was less than 3 minutes between the calls. My husband was the closest officer, and he was in the area of Old Furnace Road. It did take a few minutes driving time. He started that way on the first call, but arrived 2 minutes after the last call. End quote. For the record, Old Furnace Road is approximately 4 miles to the north of the Imperial Gas Station. On Thursday the 17th, the day Kelly would go into work that overnight shift, she was paid a visit by her younger sister, Elaine. After having an argument with one of her siblings, Elaine sought out Kelly for comfort. Kelly listened to the problem and gave Elaine advice while trying to make her feel a little better. It was, after all, a spat between siblings, and in a large family, they were bound to happen from time to time. Elaine later told NBC News, quote, "I remembered hugging her after she made me laugh, like she always did. I hugged her and said, 'Love you, sis. I'll see you this weekend.'" End quote. Unfortunately, Kelly would disappear just hours later, and Elaine would never see her again. Kelly arrived for work that night at 10 p.m. and disappeared just 4.5 hours later. Kelly's final call to police took place just a few minutes after the first two, this time at approximately 2:31 a.m. During this call, Kelly explained to the operator that the same man had returned to the station again, and she was very concerned. Reportedly, Kelly pleaded with them to help her. However, the call was cut short. Kelly's sister, Rose, later told the Daily Press that she had heard the recordings of the 911 calls, and at the end of the final call, quote, "You can hear a shuffle and the phone snaps," end quote. Kelly's mother, Rachel, also listened to the recordings and told reporters, quote, "In each call, she was getting a little bit more scared," end quote. Although we don't know exactly what time police were dispatched, we do know that Officer Sam Yankee pulled into the station within 2 minutes of the final call. When Officer Yankee entered the building, he found an eerily quiet scene. The store was vacant. All the lights were on and the door was unlocked. On the counter, the officer saw Kelly's purse, a pack of Marlboro Lights with a $5 bill stuck inside, and an open magazine Kelly had apparently been reading. I should note, in some accounts, it's been said that it was a book rather than a magazine. A cigarette Kelly had been smoking at the time was completely burned down in the ashtray. According to Lieutenant Hubert Myers of the Harrisonburg Police, it appeared as though Kelly had gone to use the restroom but never returned. There was no sign of a struggle, no money had been stolen, and nothing in the store itself was disturbed. There was some confusion initially about the vehicles. They had the description from Kelly of the silver car, but it was thought at first that Kelly may have been forced into her own car. It wasn't until an hour later that police learned Kelly had been dropped off at work by her husband and had no vehicle on the premises. Now, in terms of those timelines, there are varying reports about when all of the calls were made. Generally, the final call is listed as taking place between 2:29 and 2:31 a.m. However, in a January 1983 article, Lieutenant Myers stated, quote, "We've got everything narrowed down to 2:15 a.m. Then we've got a 15-minute gap we can't account for," end quote. Officer Yankee is reported to have arrived at the station anywhere between 2:29 and 2:32 a.m. What Myers meant by the 15-minute gap I can't quite explain, as if the police arrived 2 minutes after the final call, where do those 15 minutes come in? I've even found some accounts where the first call came in just after midnight, though I can't find any verification for that, and it's possible that's when it actually happened. Or they may be confusing the call she made to her mother, Rachel, that night. Once the vehicle confusion had been sorted out, police put out notifications and began searching for the silver car, but were never able to locate it. Lieutenant Myers expressed some concerns about Kelly's description as well, wondering if it had been completely accurate. Myers told the News Leader paper, quote, "We have to figure out first, when Kelly Dove called, did she see a silver-colored Ford? She wore glasses, was looking through tinted glass into a light. Is it silver? Was it dark gray? Was it a Ford?" End quote. I should note the Charlie Project lists Kelly as wearing contact lenses and not specifically glasses, though I've seen photos of her wearing glasses, so I don't know if she was wearing glasses that night or not. There was some consideration at the time about the possibility that Kelly may have left of her own volition, but that was rapidly dismissed, as her family were adamant that she wouldn't have disappeared by her own choice. Kelly's husband, Dale, told investigators that it was completely impossible, noting that she wouldn't have left behind her purse and cigarettes, and she absolutely would not have left her daughter behind. Tammy was her entire world, and she wouldn't have gone anywhere without her. Considering the rapid call she had made to investigators, Lieutenant Myers explained that they had no reason to believe she would have left of her own, but stated they had to examine all possibilities. The theory that developed from investigators depicted a terrifying scene. Kelly had likely been abducted by the man who had been harassing her over the 30 minutes or so before and after she called police for the first time. Measurements taken from inside the gas station showed that the payphone Kelly had been using was just 10 feet from the front door, and so investigators believe the assailant had likely pulled his vehicle up perpendicular to the front door, entered the station brandishing some kind of a weapon, and forced Kelly out the door and into his car. Myers told reporters he believed the entire abduction took less than 15 seconds. When asked why he believed the suspect had a weapon, Myers noted the lack of a struggle, explaining, quote, "She was a right smart scrapper. The man was armed. He caught her by surprise, we feel for sure," end quote. Despite the set of circumstances laid out by Myers, multiple sources report that no forensic investigation of the scene itself was conducted. Supposedly, no evidence was taken from the scene, and there was not an attempt to lift fingerprints. I have in some articles seen it noted that, being that the gas station was open 24 hours and open to the public, a search for fingerprints would have come back with hundreds of prints that authorities wouldn't have been able to track. Again, we turn to Martha Yankee, who replied to many questions on the aforementioned Facebook post. In regard to the fingerprints, Ms. Yankee explained, quote, "My husband, the responding officer, is positive that he secured the scene and that he used fingerprint dust all around," end quote. I don't know the exact details of what happened in terms of investigating the scene, but it was the early 80s, and investigation techniques weren't quite as standard or as stringent as they are today. However, there may be further evidence to suggest that the investigators did work the scene. Captain Clater of the Harrisonburg Police later told NBC's Dateline that he hoped advancements in DNA technology might help, though he wouldn't elaborate to protect the integrity of the case. This seems to imply that something must have been found at the scene which could contain DNA. Clater was also asked about the phone calls, which he noted revolved around a strange man Kelly had concerns about, though he would not comment on the exact timing of those calls. According to Elaine, the family was notified within an hour of Kelly's disappearance, at which time her mother woke her and they all went down to the gas station. Elaine told Dateline that she ran into the field behind the station hoping to see any sign of her sister, but there was nothing. When Dale learned about her disappearance, he began driving around looking for Kelly and the silver car, though he wasn't able to find anything. He continued driving for days afterwards, though he told reporters it seemed unlikely he was going to find anything if even the police were coming up short. However, for the first few weeks after her disappearance, Dale was reported to have spent every hour from the moment he woke up till the moment he went to bed searching for his wife. As part of their investigation, police traveled to other convenience stores in the areas to ask if they had seen anyone driving a silver vehicle who may have been causing any problems or acting strangely. Beyond that, they were looking for reports of obscene phone calls or incidents of indecent exposure. At a store not too far from the Imperial, police found a clerk who had not only seen someone like that in the past, but had seen someone fitting that description the very night Kelly was abducted. According to the clerk, who was never named publicly, he told investigators that on the night of Kelly's disappearance, there was a white male driving a silver-colored car who he witnessed driving past his store at least three times. Reportedly, the clerk also informed police that this same male had, some weeks prior, exposed himself to a female employee. The clerk was able to give investigators somewhat of a description, saying that the man was Caucasian, 20 to 25 years old, standing approximately 5 feet 10 inches tall, with a thin build and shoulder-length blonde hair. While police felt this was a good lead, the description wasn't exactly specific enough to help them narrow things down. Lieutenant Myers later remarked that the same description would fit half the male students at nearby James Madison University. It was a tough case to investigate. Little or no physical evidence, a description of a suspect which is a little too broad, and 3 phone calls, but nothing truly solid to go on. For police, it was a matter of finding Kelly as quickly as they could, but time kept moving forward, and before long, it had been 6 months, a year, and they were no closer to finding answers. Lieutenant Myers believed the answers were in the community and urged locals to call in with what they knew. However, after more than 500 tips were tracked down, investigators were still no closer. Some of those tips described men who may have been involved, but investigators couldn't find anything to connect them. Other tips described women who they believed might have been Kelly herself, but in each instance, police were able to find that person, and it was always a case of mistaken identity. Considering the indecent exposure, the obscenities, the phone calls, police did what most people would do. They dug into anyone in the area who had a history of arrest for exposure, for obscene phone calls, for any crime that was sex-related. While this led them to many different doorsteps, it also led them to many dead ends. Police believed thoroughly that the crime was sexually driven, but no links could be established. It's interesting to note, though, that the Imperial gas station did not receive another harassing phone call for 6 weeks after Kelly's disappearance. Over the years, many people have come down hard on the Harrisonburg Police Department, accusing them of bungling the case or being disinterested in solving it, but they weren't the only ones working it. Both the state police and the FBI were called in to assist, and despite their involvement, Kelly's case remained difficult to advance. It always seemed like a return to square one, working with the same thin evidence they had at the beginning. Within months of Kelly's disappearance, a local resident, under the cover of anonymity, donated $1,000 to be offered as a reward for information about Kelly's abduction, but that reward was never claimed. In the aftermath of Kelly's disappearance, her family struggled to come to terms with what had happened. Even now, 38 years later, members of the family are still actively involved in trying to find what became of Kelly. There are social media pages dedicated to finding her. Elaine herself is still very much involved and frequently comments on social media posts, as well as doing interviews with local and national news stations. Kelly's husband, Dale, struggled hard after losing his wife. Rachel and Fred made an offer to help raise Tammy, and Dale acquiesced, signing over full legal custody to them. While Tammy herself doesn't speak much about her mother's disappearance, she remains close with the family, who are understanding of her desire to try and keep those bad memories locked away. In nearly 40 years, dozens of people have been looked at as possibly being responsible for Kelly's abduction, though nothing concrete has ever been established, nor has a person of interest ever been named. In several articles, there have been references to someone who had gone to school with Kelly, who her parents thought could have been the assailant. This person, who has never been named publicly, reportedly had a history of indecent exposure and making lewd phone calls. The man allegedly drove a silver Ford at the time of Kelly's abduction, but if police looked into him, they apparently could not find enough to make an arrest or even name him as a person of interest. There is one name, though, which comes up frequently in conjunction to the investigation into Kelly's disappearance, and that name is Glenn Barker. Barker first came to the attention of law enforcement in North Carolina in February of 1981, 16 months before Kelly vanished. Barker was arrested and charged with assault on a female. The charge had been reduced after the victim refused to testify against him, stemming from an assault where he abducted the woman at knife point, tied her to a bed, and possibly sexually assaulted her. The victim managed to escape when Barker went outside to move her car. Authorities believe that Barker had planned to murder or severely injure the victim when he returned, but luckily, she had escaped. Barker's next run-in with the law, though, would turn deadly. On July 11th, 1982, some 23 days after Kelly's disappearance, 62 miles to the southeast in Charlottesville, 12-year-old Katie Wersky disappeared during a sleepover. According to reports of the time, Katie was sleeping in the same bed as her 13-year-old friend when she vanished. At approximately 5:30 a.m., her friend awoke to find Katie missing. Katie had left all of her belongings behind, including the insulin the diabetic youngster took once a day. Her clothes were also left behind, minus her underwear and t-shirt that she was wearing at the time she was sleeping. After investigating, police had one person of interest, Glenn Barker. At the time, Barker cooperated with investigators who searched his vehicle and his home, taking several items with them. Among these items were a pair of blood-stained young girls' underwear. There was also blood-stained men's clothing. It was later revealed that Barker was friends with Katie's friend's mother and had come by the home that evening to have a few drinks. He told investigators that he had sat down with the two young girls, playing cards and sharing beer with them. Remember, we're talking about a 12 and 13-year-old, respectively. Barker was arrested, and during the trial, it was stated that during interrogation, he had told authorities he couldn't remember what happened the night Katie vanished and that he knew something bad must have happened. In June of 1983, 1 year after Kelly vanished and 11 months after Katie, Barker was convicted of second-degree murder. This made him the second person in Virginia to be convicted on a murder charge without a body having been found. He was sentenced to 18 years in prison, 2 years less than the maximum, but was released in 1991. Katie's body has never been found. After Barker's release from prison, there was a lot of media scrutiny and public posts about his plans to move into a home that his mother had purchased. While things were getting intense, Barker met Cynthia Powers Johnson, and the two began dating. Not long into the relationship, Barker was sent back to prison for 6 months on a parole violation. He'd been driving with a pellet gun and handcuffs in his car. While Barker argued the gun was for protection, prosecutors stated that if it had just been the gun, that would have been possible. But with the handcuffs present, it seemed more likely that it was a kit he was creating to commit future sexual assaults. Barker claimed the cuffs were a toy given to him by Johnson, but she did not corroborate his story. Several years later, on August 29, 1996, 34-year-old Cynthia Powers Johnson and her 7-year-old daughter Heather were found dead in their home. Both had been stabbed, and then the killer had set the home ablaze, starting the fire in 7 different locations throughout the house, according to the Daily Press. Authorities immediately looked at Barker, who had dated Cynthia for approximately 18 months before they broke up, apparently due to Heather having issues with him. Cynthia and Heather had just returned from vacation with a new man in Cynthia's life, Gary McAllister. On the night of the murders, McAllister told authorities that he had called Cynthia from work and she seemed to be behaving oddly. He later drove by, and while he noted Cynthia's car in the driveway and the house lights off, he also noticed a pickup truck parked nearby. The pickup was later identified as belonging to Glenn Barker. Unfortunately, due to the fire, no physical evidence could be developed to conclusively link Barker to the murders. Then, there is the case of Paula Jean Chandler. Chandler was 18 years old when she disappeared on June 19, 1982, 3 weeks before the disappearance of Katie Wersky and just 1 day after the abduction of Kelly Berg Dove. According to The Hook, a weekly magazine based in Charlottesville, after getting off a shift at El Cabrito's Mexican restaurant in Charlottesville, Chandler went to a coworker's house to hang out and watch TV. After leaving, she never returned home, and 2 days later, a fisherman discovered her remains in the Ravana Reservoir. Initially, investigators were looking for the man Chandler had spent some time with that night, Michael Curry, then 19 years old. One of Chandler's shoes was found in Curry's apartment. The other was still on Chandler's foot when she was found in the reservoir. Today, Albemarle police still believe Curry was the man responsible. However, for many in the area, they think Glenn Barker is the more likely suspect. Barker lived in an apartment just 1 mile from the restaurant Chandler worked at, and Chandler herself lived in the same neighborhood from where Katie Wersky disappeared. Chandler's murder remains unsolved today, and in terms of persons of interest, authorities remain steadfast in their original suspect, Michael Curry, while others believe there's a high probability that Glenn Barker may have been responsible. This terrible crime took place just 1 day after Kelly disappeared, which in some minds makes Barker more likely, and for others, it makes him less likely to have committed two crimes so close together. On August 7th, 1986, more than 4 years after Kelly was abducted, unidentified human remains were found in Chesterfield County, Virginia, at the Shoesmith Landfill, approximately 139 miles to the southeast of the Imperial Gas Station. The victim, known as the Chesterfield Jane Doe, had been the victim of a homicide. Police believe the murder had been committed by a psychopath, noting that both the hands and the head were removed from the body with the use of a saw. These body parts have never been located. Ultimately, the medical examiner estimated that the victim had been between the ages of 22 and 32 years old at the time of her death. It was also determined that the victim had stood between 5'1" and 5'5" tall and likely weighed between 105 and 120 pounds. The victim wore a size 7 or 7.5 shoe, had bright pink toenail polish, and was wearing a rubber band-like bracelet on her left ankle. Authorities also noted that they believe the body may have been stored in a cool, insect-free environment for 2 months after death, according to Fredericksburg.com. For years, there was no way to determine the facial features of Jane Doe. However, in 2019, Parabon Nano Labs used DNA phenotyping to depict, for the first time, her most likely appearance. The official report shows a young woman with dark hair, fair skin, and dark eyes, and the resemblance is remarkably close to that of Kelly Berg Dove. Further testing showed that the victim may have lived in or had ties to Richmond, Charlottesville, Buena Vista, and Lynchburg areas of Virginia. There's also the possibility of Baltimore, Maryland. For the record, Richmond is 131 miles to the southeast of Harrisonburg. Charlottesville is 96 miles to the southeast. Buena Vista is 64 miles to the southwest, and Lynchburg is 97 miles to the south. Baltimore is the outlier, being 168 miles to the northeast. In a Facebook post for the Aware Foundation, they noted that they had received multiple emails regarding the new phenotyped image in relation to photographs of Kelly Dove. In response, Aware posted a message from Kelly's sister, which reads, quote, "I talked with a Chesterfield detective this morning, and he will be pushing Kelly's DNA test up the list. Some things about the remains are similar to Kelly," he said. "He received over 800 calls about this picture, and he has all of the information I could give him," end quote. Chesterfield Jane Doe's NamUs number is UP6642. There have been 11 DNA comparisons against Kelly's DNA, but the Chesterfield Jane Doe is not yet one of them. This Facebook post was made in March of this year, just a few months back. Hopefully, sooner than later, the results will be released, but until then, this remains a solid possibility. The height, weight, skin tone, eye color, and hair color all fit within the parameters of Kelly's description. For 38 years, the fate of Kelly Berg Dove has remained a mystery. On August 28, 2017, just 2 days before what would have been her 56th birthday, friends and family gathered to hold a vigil. It was the second time her family had gotten together specifically to remember and mourn her. It was an emotional day in which they talked of Kelly, displayed boards covered in pictures of her, and they continued to hope for a resolution. Rachel Berg, then 77, told reporters that she planned to hold a vigil every year going forward until the answers were found. While Kelly had been officially declared dead in 1989, Rachel remained focused that her daughter was still out there somewhere, saying, quote, "I don't know if it's a mother's feeling, but she's not gone," end quote. Kelly Berg Dove is described as being a Caucasian female with brown hair and brown eyes, standing 5'1" tall and weighing approximately 105 pounds. Kelly wore a partial dental plate in place of her two front teeth. She has a scar on the back of her head and one on her forehead at the hairline. At the time of her disappearance, she was a cigarette smoker. Kelly was last seen at the Imperial gas station located at 2141 South Main Street in Harrisonburg, Virginia. When last seen, Kelly was wearing a light-colored pinstripe V-neck sweater, tan or cream-colored slacks, sandals, and a Turner Ashby High School class ring. If alive today, Kelly would be turning 59 this August. She has been missing for 38 years. Pending the results of the DNA test, some answers may be found in terms of what happened to Kelly Berg Dove. But even if those answers are found, there is still the question of who was responsible and whether or not they will face justice for this atrocious crime. When speaking to Dateline, Kelly's sister Elaine explained, quote, "This man took away a sister, daughter, mother, and my best friend. He took away her future, her chance to have more children, and to enjoy being a grandma to two little boys. It's been 36 years next week, and I never knew I could miss her more today than I did when she first went missing." True crime is my passion, but even I need the occasional break. So when I feel like I need a mental palate cleanser, my go-to refresher is Best Fiends. Best Fiends engages your brain with challenging and fun puzzles. The game presents bright colors, fun challenges, and cute little bug characters battling against evil slugs. I love the art style and the satisfaction I get destroying those slugs and marching through the levels. While Best Fiends is a challenge, it's a casual game that anyone can play, even if it's made for adults. I often play while waiting for appointments, chatting on the phone, or just chilling out on the couch. I just made it to level 351, and I don't know what I enjoy more, the challenges of the puzzles, the fun of the game, or the thrill of getting further and further. I really enjoy being able to share my progress on social media while competing with friends to see who can get further along the path. Oftentimes, the game notifies me when I pass a friend, and I really like the thrill of the hunt. I really love how Best Fiends updates every month with new levels and events so it never gets old. I also get a kick out of earning new fiends, leveling them up, and seeing what new ways I can approach the puzzles. Engage your brain with fun puzzles and collect tons of cute characters. Trust me, with over 100 million downloads, this 5-star rated mobile game is a must play. Download Best Fiends free on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's Friends without the R. Best Fiends. Kelly Berg Dove went to work one night expecting it to be just another graveyard shift. Instead, she found herself being tormented by a sick pervert who ultimately was involved in her abduction. For 38 years, her family and investigators have tried to track down the person who abducted her, and for 38 years, they have come up short. I can't imagine the horror of not knowing what happened to someone you love, nor the pain and difficulty of continuing to live every day with that question in the back of your mind. Yet, that is exactly what Kelly's family have had to endure for far too long. There's a few different theories about what may have happened, or perhaps more accurately, who may have been responsible. Some believe it may have been someone she had gone to school with. For others, they believe Glenn Barker played the role. Still yet others believe this may have been a random crime committed by someone authorities never got a name for. All have their pros and cons, But before we examine these theories, I wanted to first address the new developments with the Chesterfield Jane Doe. Chesterfield Jane Doe was found in August of 1986, 4 years and 2 months after Kelly vanished. The exact location she was found at was in Shoesmith Landfill, approximately 140 miles from the Imperial Gas Station. For years, Chesterfield Jane Doe was listed without an approximation of her physical appearance due to the fact that her killer had decapitated her and her head was not actually found. Technology at the time would not allow for her physical features to be accurately depicted, but now, thanks to advancements, they were able to create her appearance through phenotyping. When I first saw the image reproduced by Parabon Nanolabs, I was taken aback. The presumed appearance of the Chesterfield Jane Doe is remarkably close to images of Kelly, so much so that even her family had an emotional response seeing the composite. Then, when you factor in other details such as height, weight, eye color, and hair color, along with determinations of areas she may have lived, they're all within a certain radius of Harrisonburg. What details investigators know beyond those which are public, we can't say for sure, but based on Kelly's sister's statement, it seems they think there's a chance it could be Kelly. I would love to see the Jane Doe identified as Kelly, not just to give her family answers, but also to bring a name to a Jane Doe who for so long has existed without one. If this is a match, it could dramatically change the scope of the investigation and help develop new leads. The landfill was near Richmond, which makes me somewhat believe the victim may have actually been from Richmond, but until there's a match, there's no way to know for sure. All we do know is that whoever killed Jane Doe did so in a brutal fashion, and we can only hope that that person will face justice for their crimes. However, if this Jane Doe does turn out to be Kelly, there are certainly some questions which will be raised. Surely, there can be inaccuracies, but assuming the medical examiner was right, then Jane Doe had only been dead for 2 months or so before she was found. If indeed it is Kelly, that would mean she was alive up until May or June of 1986, 4 years after she disappeared. Where could she have been during that time, and why, if it is Kelly, was she kept alive for years before her killer finally struck? The implications may be horrifying, but they may also help lead to her killer. For now, we wait for the DNA testing to be conducted, but sooner than later, we're gonna have an answer one way or another. In terms of the suspects in Kelly's case, there haven't been many. At least, there haven't been many who have been named. The first suspect to address would be one that her parents leaned towards, a man who had attended high school with her and had a history of making obscene phone calls and exposing himself. We don't know exactly who this is, but if the accusations are true, then it certainly spells out a good chance that this could be the assailant. One must assume police spoke with this person and either didn't have enough to charge him, or maybe didn't have enough to name him as a person of interest. I find it fascinating that it's never been addressed publicly. I couldn't find a statement anywhere from someone in law enforcement talking about this particular person, even if just to say they were told about him and were looking into it. To me, that means they looked into it and didn't think it was him, or maybe they did think it was him and didn't want to give off the indication that he was being looked at more closely. Either way, we know very little about this individual, so we can only work on what we do know. If you're like me, then you've got one question in your mind. If the man harassing Kelly that night was this guy she went to high school with, why didn't she identify him to police when she called? That's a question which has been asked a lot in different places, and the answer always seems to be the same. 3 years had passed since high school, since Kelly had seen him, and maybe she didn't recognize him. I suppose that's a possibility, but it's always bothered me. Maybe it's just me, but I've seen people I went to high school with after 15 years and still recognize them. At a minimum, I was able to say that they looked familiar. As far as we know in those calls, at no point did Kelly say she knew the man or that he looked familiar. At the same time, I don't know that we've ever been told 100% of what Kelly said on those calls. If this were just a fleeting glance situation, then it might make more sense to me, but it wasn't. This was a man that Kelly saw at least twice before she was abducted, and obviously someone she would have seen during the end of her final call. She didn't specify who the man was. She wasn't able to identify the car. Sure, she could have forgotten, or maybe he was someone she never knew in school, just someone who had attended at the same time as her. Surely that happens. I know there's people I went to high school with who I have absolutely no recollection of. We just happened to be there at the same time. In several locations, I found statements that this former classmate drove a silver Ford. If that's true, then it's certainly going to add credence to this theory, but this theory doesn't seem to have gone much of anywhere. There's never been developments on it. Hell, there's never been anything beyond a casual sentence about it in an article here and there. I'd like to be able to go more in depth on this theory, but the fact is, there's almost nothing to work with. All I can truly say here is that this man has to be considered a possibility unless police have ruled him out based on information they've never revealed, or maybe still consider him a person of interest but have never had enough to actually name him publicly. Also, I think it's worth considering, Kelly switched shifts with her sister that night. She wasn't originally supposed to be working, so if this classmate was specifically looking for Kelly, how did he know she would be there? Was it just a coincidence, or is there more to that story? That's an answer I'd love to give you, but I simply don't have it. That brings us to Glenn Barker, a man many people have considered to be connected to Kelly's disappearance. We know that Barker had a history of abduction and murder. Looking at the cases he was attached to, he faced jail time for assault and was convicted of second-degree murder in another. He was a suspect in the murder of his ex-girlfriend and her daughter, and for some, he's a suspect in the murder of Paula Jean Chandler. I should note, at least in Chandler's case, he wasn't considered a suspect by authorities, and from what I've read, she really didn't match his typical behaviors. I didn't see anything about her being sexually assaulted, and her cause of death was blunt force rather than stabbing, so I think his involvement in that crime is somewhat debatable. However, I also think Barker's actions speak for themselves. He was violent, prone to sexual assault and murder, and didn't seem to care much whether or not he was caught. He drank heavily and used drugs, and more than once argued that he was either messed up on something when he committed a crime, or, like in the case of Katie Wersky, he simply couldn't remember. Right. I've seen photos of Barker around the time Kelly disappeared. He certainly fit the blonde hair as described by the clerk who saw the man driving the silver car that night. Of course, height-wise, things are a little off. The clerk described the man as being approximately 5 feet 10 inches tall, whereas Barker himself is 6 foot 5 inches. If it were 6'1 or 6'2, that's a discrepancy I could buy, but we're talking a difference of 7 inches here. That's hard to get wrong. But then again, some people are just terrible at guessing height, and we don't know the context of the description. He could have said 5'10", or he could have pointed to one of the police officers and said something like, he was a little taller than you. I read in some blogs and heard in some YouTube videos that Barker owned a Ford and may have been seen painting it the day after Kelly disappeared. The thing about this is, I can't verify that anywhere. It wasn't in any news article or official release that I've read while doing research for this case. In fact, every time I looked at Glenn Barker's vehicles, all I could find was a pickup truck. That doesn't mean he didn't own a Ford car. That doesn't mean he wasn't painting it the day after. But it does mean I can't tell you that's a fact. Several sites reported this detail by saying news reports claimed he had been seen painting, but I wasn't able to find any of those news reports. So does Barker fit the abduction and murder MO? Yes, but there are some questions here. I can't find a single account of Barker ever having made or being accused of making threatening or obscene phone calls. I have no records or indications that he was ever seen, arrested, or charged with any form of indecent exposure. Surely that doesn't rule him out, but it does throw a few wrenches into the MO of the man who took Kelly, especially if he was the same man seen by the other clerk. It seems a bit strange that he would randomly decide to do these things, going against his normal approach, But we're also talking about a guy who did a lot of drugs and drank a lot, so it's kind of hard to know exactly what he might have been doing from moment to moment. Here, though, is the one set of details that makes me question whether or not he may have been involved in Kelly's abduction. Barker's first victim, the one he abducted at knife point, was the girlfriend of a guy he knew. His second victim, Katie Wersky, was the friend of his friend's daughter. Barker dated Cynthia Powers Johnson and, as such, spent time with her and her daughter, Heather. All of Barker's known crimes, or the ones in which he's heavily suspected, involve people that he knew through one way or another. A friend's child's friend, an ex-girlfriend, a friend's girlfriend. Hell, if you go down the road of believing that Chandler was one of his victims, she worked at a restaurant a mile from his house and lived in the neighborhood Katie Wersky's disappeared from. This was a guy who seemingly attacked people he knew and people he had access to. That doesn't really fit with Kelly being abducted from over 60 miles away in a town that Barker has no ties to. Now, that doesn't mean Barker couldn't have committed this crime. Maybe he passed through Harrisonburg here and there and spent his time exposing himself or making harassing phone calls. Maybe he saw Kelly or someone else at that gas station at some point and it always stuck in his mind and he made plans to return. Maybe he spent that night drinking or doing drugs, slowly building up the courage to commit this crime. The fact is, we may never know for sure, but a lot of people believe it was Barker who was responsible. Barker died in 2014 and always denied being involved in Kelly's disappearance, but it's also important to note that he also denied being involved in Katie Wersky's disappearance and death even after he was convicted of it. In order to attribute Kelly's abduction to Barker, we would need more information. Exactly what kind of car did he own in June of 82? Where was he during that time? Was he down in Charlottesville where he was when Katie disappeared, or was he living elsewhere? I haven't been able to find much on Barker in terms of hard facts, and even his conviction in North Carolina for assault in 1981 has been difficult for me to find anything on. The fact remains, Barker is certainly a person I would be looking at if I were the investigator, and I am sure police did look at him, but apparently not then nor now have they been able to come up with anything to make a solid connection between Barker and Kelly. We've looked at the classmate, and we've looked at Barker. Outside of those two, there's really only one other possibility, that this crime was committed by someone we've never been told about. Now, that doesn't mean it's someone police aren't aware of, but it's certainly someone the public has never been made aware of. Of course, though, it could be someone that no one has been considering. Someone passing through, someone random, someone who managed to avoid ever coming onto the radar of any investigators. That's a possibility we can't ignore. Unfortunately, when it comes to this particular theory, we have even less to work with than any of the others, and they didn't have a whole lot. We have the report from the other clerk that someone in a silver car passed by his store and in the past had exposed himself to a female employee. We have Kelly's sisters who have said that obscene and harassing phone calls were somewhat common when working the overnight shift at the Imperial. Whether that's the result of the same person or a combination of different people, at least in terms of the phone calls, we simply don't know. It seems somewhat unlikely that this person lived far away and made a long trek in the middle of the night to harass female employees at a local gas station and convenience store, but it's not entirely possible to rule that out either. I did find it interesting that the Imperial received no harassing phone calls for 6 weeks after Kelly's abduction, though. The Imperial wasn't very far from Interstate 81. More than likely, anyone driving along that stretch of interstate in that area would have known about the location of the gas station. How many people went through every day? How many went through every night? There's no way to be sure, but that certainly opens the door up to a larger pool of potential suspects. There's certainly the possibility that it could have been a local, someone living in Harrisonburg who was responsible for the calls and the harassment, and even Kelly's abduction. If that were the case, that would mean that for years before, and possibly years after, there's a good chance that while everyone was searching desperately for Kelly and her abductor, the very person they sought may have been hiding in plain sight. And that only makes things all the more disturbing and horrifying. Kelly Berg Dove vanished in the early morning hours of June 18th, 1982. Her story is that of nightmares, the kind of fears everyone who has ever worked an overnight shift in a convenience store or gas station has thought about at one point or another. Kelly was a smart woman. She was sharp and she was fierce. And someone stole her away from her family, robbed her daughter of a mother who loved her dearly, and destroyed all of the dreams and goals Kelly ever had. For 38 years, the questions have been asked, and for all that time, those answers have failed to come through. Maybe, if the DNA matches, one more piece of the puzzle will fall into place. Maybe then the picture will become more clear. Maybe then justice might be done. Until that happens, though, and especially if it does not, the abduction of Kelly Berg Dove will remain open, unsolved, and cold. If you're looking for more information about the abduction of Kelly Berg Dove, there are some websites and forums discussing her case. You can find her on Namus under MP1092. And the Doe Network under 2413-DFVA. If you have any information about the abduction of Kelly Berg Dove, please contact the Harrisonburg Police Department at 540-434-2545. What do you believe happened? Tweet me at TraceEvPod, message me on Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, comment in the Facebook group or email me at traceevidencepod@gmail.com. Lately, a lot of people have been asking me about the availability of Trace Evidence merchandise. In order to view Trace Evidence merchandise, you have two options. You can go to traceevidence.threadless.com or go to the website at trace-evidence.com and click on the merch link for all purchasing options. If you're looking to support Trace Evidence and you want access to ad-free episodes and monthly bonus episodes in addition to receiving Trace Evidence stickers and merchandise, please visit patreon.com/traceevidence. The word forensics often brings to mind white lab coats and latex gloves, but forensic detectives spend their days rushing from crime scene to crime scene with no resources to help deal with the emotional trauma that follows. Brought to you by CrimeCon, the new podcast, Shattered Souls, A Forensic Detective's Diary, follows the forensic detective veteran, Karen Smith, as she revisits her poignant and detailed journals to share the stories of victims you've likely never heard of, but who she can't forget, and the shattered souls left behind in their wake. CrimeCon presents Shattered Souls debuted on May 9th on your favorite podcast streaming platform. Learn more at crimecon.com/podcast. Now it's time to thank Trace Evidence's amazing Patreon producers: Alicia Lorraine, Brett Eady, Brittany Bivens, Brian Kemmerling, Christine Greco, Krista Colvin, Diane Dyson, Eamon Brady, Emily Smith, Emma Vachon, Jessica Chagnon, Jessica Yunt, Kevin Bonham, Lee Campbell, Megan Cotter, Michael Graves, Nick Mohar Schurz, Pamela Coburn, Quinn McBreen, Roberta Jansen, Samantha Ford, Stephanie Siegerist, Stephen Weiland, Tara Doble, Tom Archer, and Tracy Woods. Thank you all so much for your kindness and amazing support of Trace Evidence. That's going to do it for this week's episode. Make sure to follow me on social media at TraceEvPod on Twitter, TraceEvidencePod on Instagram, TraceEvidencePodcast on YouTube, or search Facebook for Trace Evidence Podcast. For questions, comments, case suggestions, email me at traceevidencepod@gmail.com. All social media links, contact forms, merchandise links, and more are available on the website at trace-evidence.com. I want to thank you so much for listening, and I hope you'll join me next week for another unsolved case on the next episode of Trace Evidence.